So our survey then is a serendipitous cluster survey being done using archival XMM data. So this is public data available from XMM. So XMM's got a half degree field of view, so wherever it's observing, there's a lot of area around these pointings where you can search for clusters. This is what we're doing. They've got three main science goals. Firstly, we're trying to do cosmology using clusters, looking at the cluster mass function, evolution with redshift. Probably most pertinent to this meeting is looking at, as a second science goal, looking at the evolution of the properties of the cluster gas with redshift, as traced by the X-ray scaling relations. So principally for us, that's between luminosity and temperature. And of course, you need to know this, as we've said, to be able to do cosmology with clusters. And finally, we're also looking at things to do with galaxy evolution in clusters. So why use XMM? Previously, people have used ROSAT surveys to do cosmology. And recently, we've had the nice results from the 400 square degree survey followed up with Chandra by Viglin and et al, which have shown that you can get competitive constraints on at least some cosmological parameters using clusters. So this is the Viglin and et al constraints on sigma 8 compared to WMAP and some weak lensing thing, I think. So with XMM, our advantage over doing this with ROSAT is that basically we get XMM is much more sensitive, so you can get to higher redshifts. We have higher resolution, which helps as well. And we can get to fainter fluxes, meaning in most cases that we're actually just getting more low temperature systems in there as well, which is also useful for doing the cluster physics. And we build much larger samples than what you can with ROSAT. And a big advantage as well of using XMM is that we get essentially free temperatures for many clusters where we detect new clusters with enough counts to be able to measure a temperature. So I'm not going to label this too much because this has been covered a lot so far. As we've seen, X-ray survey is pretty complementary, as said. Here are the scaling relations, and we know these don't really work because these are the ones just assuming gravitational collapse, so is the main sort of like property what determines. Process which determines cluster properties. So we know that we need feedback to alter these, alter the scaling relations to get to what we observe. And of course, the SZ's also a factor, as it still depends on electron density, temperature, gas, etc. In terms of sky coverage, so our sky coverage is whatever's in the XMM archive. So at present, we've processed 166 square degrees, which is the blue point. So there's a terrible choice of colors on this plot, but the galaxy is here. So we're actually processing everything. Some people are interested in looking for isolated neutron stars and stuff like that for some reason. And these red points show this. So like expected the extra air, what we get up to April 2009, where we process the images. So this gets us up to 293 square degrees, but we haven't run the source detection on this yet. And this just shows you the exposure times in the XMM archive. So typically, 10 kiloseconds is where most things are. We actually find from our selection function stuff that the optimal for doing cluster surveys is probably about 30 kiloseconds in terms of a sweet spot for detecting clusters and not gaining much by going deeper than that. So we have three automated pipelines to process the XCS data. So our first one is generating the images from the observational data file, which gives us images like this. And then we have another pipeline to do the source detection, which is wavelet-based. So we have a catalog covering 166 square degrees with about 2,000 cluster candidates in it, nearly 400 of which are... There's a gunshot. Nearly 400 of which have more than 300 counts, so we can measure a temperature from those with probably an error of about 25%, we reckon. For more than 500 counts, we have about 230 clusters. You get an error of about 20% on the temperature. So this isn't our typical ODF, but you can see we're detecting clusters here as the big extended sources in green. So to do these temperatures, we can cut out all the observations in the direction of a particular object, fit the X-ray spectrum for the temperature, fitting plasma models. We fit the surface brightness profile in order to measure LX. And we can also measure redshift directly from the X-ray spectra in some cases, if we have enough counts. This has a pretty big error on it, 0.15, but it's better than nothing. And this is just this is an example of an X-ray spectrum of a fitted temperature. So this has got like a few thousand counts in it, which isn't typical. So this is like a plasma model. So so it'd be like a Mikal model. So it'll be like things like a methyl steam, which I think probably is something to do. But I don't know the details. So in terms of contamination, now I won't make any bones about it. This isn't great for an X-ray survey. So down at 100 counts, we're getting like nearly 25% contamination of things, which is not a cluster. But we determine this by basically the whole team eyeballing candidates in SDSS, so we can sort of like find where things are like blended point sources and stuff like that, and throw it out. So we want to get do better on this. So we're trying. So the main limitation of this is the current knowledge of the XMM PSF, particularly when you get off axis, it does some interesting things. So we're trying to get a better handle on that. But it's not too bad when you get into several hundred counts, which is where it's more interesting anyway, in terms of doing temperature. So we're, you know, between 10 and 15% or so. To do anything with cluster surveys, we need to get redshifts. And this is a big task when you're trying to follow up 2,000 cluster candidates. So this shows our current like progress towards this. So this is a big histogram of all the redshifts we've got, of varying degrees of quality in here. So nearly 900 in total, 130 from literature, nearly 400 from SDSS, over 200 from our own survey, NXS, which I'll mention in a minute, and 129, which is a mixture of our own spectroscopy, the X-ray spectroscopy redshifts, and some more photos as well. It's a bit of a mixed bag. And this just breaks it down in terms of the number of counts. So you can see that for 300 and 500 counts, if we go back to the numbers earlier, we're about 60% redshift complete at this point. So we have an optical survey following up XMM pointings to try and get redshift. So we're using this red sequence technique used by the red sequence cluster survey of imaging fields in R and Z to get photometric redshifts, typically accurate to about 0.05 or so, over the range up to about redshift 1. So this is using the mosaic cameras at Kitt Peak and CTIO. We've observed a total of 149 fields. We've not been very lucky with the weather. We've actually had 46 nights, we've only had 24. And the seeing's also been a bit rubbish. But we still get some nice results out of this. So this redshift pipeline has been put together by one of our students, Nicola Merton. As well as the process of all the images. So this is an example of a cluster of redshift 0.27. And this is a kind of decent high redshift candidate. But redshift 0.9 of the X-ray here only has about 60 counts. The green ellipse is like the source detection ellipse from the pipeline.
And the spectrum?
No, this is from the photometric redshift. So we're not really sure about the errors. At this point, this is really high redshift. So moving on to what we expect to do with cosmology with XDS. So this is described in the Sahl and et al. Paper. So this is assuming a final XDS area of 500 square degrees, which is what we expect the XMM archive to get up to by the time the mission finishes. So here we're using temperature as our mass proxy. We're only including clusters in more than 500 counts. We include the effects of the XDS selection function, or a prototype version of it. Measurement errors in temperature and photometric redshifts that we expect. A big constraint we have here is you have to assume flatness. We can't really constrain dark energy doing this. But we do test the effects of different assumptions to do with the LT relation, evolution, whether it's constant, which is might be what you expect more in a feedback kind of model, or if it's self-similar. The effect of the scaling relations, so 10% in mass temperature, 30% in LT. And then also doing the self-calibration technique where you try to fit for the evolution of the LT relation using the temperature and redshift and other counts. So these are the underlying distributions what you get. So the pink and green is in the case where you have no scatter. If you have scatter in the MT relation, LT relation, then you detect a lot more clusters from a kind of Malmquist bias. So
say, scattering more things above whatever your particular flux element is. Then if you followed in the XCS selection function, the things look like this. So this is the same prediction of cosmology, so there's no difference in the cosmologies here, but you can see there's a fairly sizable difference in the numbers of clusters what you expect. In particular, we expect the most if the L2 relation is self-similar and there's this range of the scatter. So just a few words on the selection function. So it's currently a bit simplistic. So we are using beta models, where we're inserting them into the observation data files and putting in the instrumental effect and so on. However, this doesn't seem to be too terrible. So actually, I'm showing it here for a cloud cluster. So this is from a hydro simulation, where we put in the instrumental effect, then we put it into whatever we have. We run the source detection. We can find it or not. So we find that actually comparing to this putting in clusters from this numerical simulation, that we get probably within 5% of just using a canonical beta model in terms of our detection efficiencies. And also that it's not actually biased against clusters which are, whether they're relaxed or unrelaxed looking. I'm not sure what the criteria is. In terms of constraints, so ignoring the measurement errors, and the best you could possibly do would be to get omega minus 2 within 0.02 for 500 squared units, so I think it's 0.02, assuming omega total is 1. If you throw in the self-calibration, this puffs up the errors considerably. So this is increasing error on sigma 8 by more than a factor of 2 to the case where we don't do the self-calibration. So I think this is mostly because you're adding in 3 extra parameters which you need to fit for. And I think the slope of the L2 relation and the scatter in it are quite degenerate. So. No, this hasn't got any. This hasn't got any priors in it. In that kind. Well, okay. So there are a few and a detail in the Saarland paper, I think. But they're like very broad. So like, you know, minimal. No,
this is purely from the clusters.
So scatter is also a parameter that you marginalize over?
Yes, for the LT, yeah. If you throw in the measurement errors, then we find that actually, as long as you think you understand your redshift errors, then this doesn't actually affect things too much, even if you're using photometric redshifts. So these worst case scenarios at the bottom are, we assume the photometric redshift error is twice as bad as what we think, and we also throw in catastrophic errors and stuff, maybe 10% or something. And temperature error is 3 times worse than what we expect. We still get sigma 8 to less than 0.04, what we expect. So I've just got a few notes here on comparing this to the 400 squared degree stuff. So you may notice the constraints we have aren't actually that much better than what you get from a much smaller sample from the 400 squared degree. And apparently the reason for this is because the 400 squared degree result rely on this adoption of this prior on H from the HSTT project to get constraints that they do, which is not actually in these XCS predictions. In our case, this shape parameter for the power spectrum is fixed instead. So future work for this is to look at these other match properties to see if you can get dark engine constraints, because to the Klinner et al. Shown using YX, which depends on angular diameter distance, then you can start to constrain dark energy. We can also go to lower counts because we find that the temperature errors aren't so much worse by going to 300 counts rather than 500. But the main thing which we're going to do is to directly fit the L2 relation to evolution and put in the luminosity information as well as the temperatures, which is different to the self-calibration thing. But we just don't know. We think that will improve things a lot, but we don't know about how much yet, because we haven't done it. So moving on to the scaling relations, then. As we've seen earlier, then if you make incorrect assumptions about these, then you can get some pretty big systematic errors. Again, this is from the Saarland paper. You can see, for example, if your data are actually consistent with a constant luminosity temperature relation, but you fit the zooming self-similarity, then you could see you would bias something about a high and sigma rate low, and so on. There's various different scenarios here. So it's really important that we understand that before we can do this model. So where we think that doing X-ray surveys can help with it, but in terms of our input to our data set surveys, would be to help constrain these models of possibly the evolution of the gas. So this is a plot of the evolution of the normalization of the LTU relation with redshift for three different simulations, which all pretty much get the same results for the normalization of low redshift, and they all reproduce the LTU slope. They all evolve very differently with redshift. So you can see there's a pretty big difference between these three models once you get to redshift 0.6 or so. So these are like models with feedback, reheating, or just the radius.
So these are targeted feedback models, or specifically a target?
I'm not sure what the details of these models are, actually. I think these are very simple cases, I think, in this particular paper. It's one long case on the paper.
So you inject just the right amount that can match the relations locally, and then you basically just let it go?
I think it's something like that, yeah. I don't know the details. Another thing where the LTU relations can probably help as well is actually constrained galaxy formation models. So we saw some stuff from the Durham semiotic simulations earlier this morning. So for semiotic galaxy formation models to kind of match the observed luminosity function, they need to include feedback from AGM. So the VAR et al. 2006 model is very successful at reproducing the galaxy luminosity function. And it's evolution, but if you just take that and try and predict the LT relation, it gets it quite wrong. So VAR et al. Have gone back and looked at this for a 2008 paper, and have actually tried to build a model which can do both things at the same time. So you can see here they've managed to reproduce the LT relation compared to data pretty well. So I think this is like the average of the simulation. It's the data scattered around. And they also get a decent attempt at the galaxy luminosity function. Although obviously the normalization is pretty higher than what's observed here. So it's not perfect, but these are the kinds of things that people can do. In terms of observations, we really don't know how the LT relation normalization evolves with redshift at the moment. It's not really very well constrained by observations at all. So this is like from the warp sample at high redshift for the Morn et al. These are one sigma error ones. So you can see this is consistent with a self-similar picture, but it's also consistent with these void kind of semiotic kind of modeling, which is like for a cooling, like a gradient cooling type setup, and one which is more similar to void expected feedback, which gives you actually a negative evolution. So in this case, you'd expect clusters to be fainter at high redshift than at low redshift, which would make, yeah, the numbers you expect to do for modeling are a bit different. And similarly, it's also important to include the effects of the selection function. So this is some nice work from XMMLSS by Picorditar. So this is their raw data, effectively, for the evolution of the LT relation. And when they throw in the selection function effects, so without including selection function, they would get something steeper than self-similar. But including the selection function, they get something which is consistent with self-similar. But this is like a one sigma error bar kind of thing. So it's, again, it's unconstrained. But this is a small sample. They only put a spot to 20 degrees and most of it to register function. So with XTS, we're hoping to measure this pretty well. We think we'll be able to do this. So this is a very preliminary result from just throwing in what we have at the moment. I'm just fitting an LT relation. So there's no selection function in this at all. We still get a sensible looking slope. This is the LT relation we expect from the CLEP simulation, which is lower. I don't know why that is, but apparently it's nothing to worry about. So. So the main thing we can do with a sample the size of ours is to look at the evolution as a function of look-back time. So to do this, you want to get a decent number of clusters each bin. So these are simulations by Lloyd Davis showing for different amounts of LT scatter, the number of clusters you need in a bin to get a particular error on the LT normalizations. So once you get to about 30 clusters or so, it's pretty flat. It's not increasing much in terms of reconstructive depth work because of the intrinsic scale.
And so with our sample, you can see we can do this. We're probably going to be able to do this better than any survey out there at the moment because of the number of clusters we've got up to these reds. So these are the sort of redshifts in each bin. So at intermediate redshifts, we've got like 70 clusters. There's things to worry about here is like the number of photo Zs and spectro Zs, which we can chip away at. We've asked for Gemini time to get to fill this in and get these all the spectroscopic redshifts, which would really help. Also, we don't do terribly well at the low redshift end, but we can fill that in with a sample from, say, Hyperlux or something which has been observed with XMM and has a well understood selection function. In terms of the temperature distribution, this just shows that we get a lot more low temperature systems. We have a lot of groups in the sample, which will be interesting to look at. Also, this is some other kind of impact where you can get from looking at scaling relations with XCS is to try and calibrate masses for optical cluster surveys as well. So this is a very preliminary kind of plot of temperature versus N200, which is like a richness-based mass estimator. This is from our NXS survey, but you can imagine applying this to a large cluster sample constructed from DES optically selected, for example, to get the mass. This is just to give you a flavor of the kind of thing what we can do. So I'm now going to move on to talk about a little bit about some work we've been doing on galaxy evolution in high redshift clusters. Where a set effect can come into this is that we don't know very many high redshift clusters at present. So with the set effect being nearly redshift independent, we hope that this will be able to find us a lot more. So here I've got a list of these are the six most distant high redshift clusters, spectroscopically confirmed known to date. So these are mainly coming, now we're getting a lot of clusters at high redshift from Spitzer, still have two from XMM. And so because fewer of these things are known, it would be really good to find a lot more to be able to characterize a high redshift galaxy population and constrain the galaxy formation models. So I'll just tell you a little bit about some work we've been doing on pulling up clusters in XCS and elsewhere. So this is the redshift 1.46 cluster we discovered with XCS, which is at a redshift corresponding to a lookback time of 9 gigayears. So with this cluster, we've been looking at doing the first study of the galaxy morphologies and the color magnitude relation in a cluster at about redshift 1.5. So here there's a plot of photometrically selected members in yellow and spectroscopic members in blue. So for this, we have data from HST and Subaru. So this is some very brief highlights. So this is so unsurprisingly, because this only corresponds to a lookback time about 0.5 gigayears later than what you see at redshift 1.3 or so, we find that the morphological fractions are pretty similar to clusters of redshift 1. Being nearly sort of like 50-50-ish between ellipticals and spirals or irregulars. So we also looked at the color magnitude relation. So this is a bit of a busy plot, but this is basically everything within our field of view from ACS and Morax. And if you add in if you do the photometric redshift selection, this is what you're left with. So interesting things here is a lack of an obvious BCG in this cluster. We've also got a deficit of faint red galaxies down here. So these lines here are the five sigma detection limits in blue. This is the green line is the approximate morphological selection limit. Then we've got our fifth there. The black squares highlight the ones with spectroscopic redshifts. In terms of ages, again, we don't find anything too surprising. Fitting for the scatter with in the color magnitude relation using stellar population models, we get ages of about 3 gigayears. Corresponds to a redshift formation 4, so this is similar to what you find at redshift 1.3 as well. So moving on a little bit, we've also used some of our Subaru data to test semi-analytic models of BCG formation. high redshift. So from the latest semiotic models, you expect the evolution in the stellar mass of these galaxies to be pretty dramatic. So they're increasing in stellar mass by about a factor of 5 from redshift 1 or so. So these are the super images of our clusters with the X and M contours overlaid. In terms of the colors from J minus K, the semiotic model from De Lucia and Blaser actually predicts the colors really, really well. So this is the prediction in the semiotic models compared to the simple stellar population models. And then we go to the stellar masses. So this is, there's some big assumptions in this. But we find that from the K-band, turning this into a stellar mass, that these are actually, these galaxies are a lot more massive than what you expect in these semiotic models. And this is true for the Bauer-Rethal models as well. So here we've got a red point showing our data. And then this is like data from the De Lucia and Blaser model from the based on the Millennium simulation. These error bars are the one sigma. These are the standard deviation of this population. So you can see 2215 is actually consistent with, and this is like everything in the simulation. So you see 2215 is pretty much consistent with the Millennium simulation, but the other galaxies tend to be brighter. So one caveat with this would be if you did a larger simulation, you might expect to find more VCGs. The other thing would be that the kind of the volume probed by observations isn't really terribly well defined because this is a fairly heterogeneous sample. So you could imagine doing this with a homogeneous cluster sample from X-ray or SR, and you'd be able to more directly relate the properties of the galaxies in the simulations to the observations. Okay. So I'm going to stop there with my summary. So we're currently with XCS, we're covering 166 square degrees with about 2,000 cluster candidates. We're about 60% redshift complete, and we've got analysis for another 130 square degrees underway. For final survey, we expect to measure omega matter to 10%, sigma 8 to 6%, assuming flatness from the cluster data alone. We're making progress towards getting towards measuring the redshift evolution and the scaling relations, which would be useful for all cluster surveys, I think. We can get some good measurements of that. And we're also doing some follow-up studies in the optical for looking at the properties of the galaxies in these high-redshift clusters. So that's it. So the main problem is obviously optical follow-up, which is, you know, the killer. Yeah. So I mean, eventually this problem will solve itself because like DES is coming, and you know, ESO surveys in the south, which will help a lot. So in the north we've got Sloan, you can do a lot with Sloan. But you know, we need, yeah. I mean, the coverage in the south is lacking. So yeah.
Couple
of and yeah, also there's the factor of the XNM archive building up area slowly. So, I mean, I don't think we can really compete with SF surveys in terms of area coverage. So, the number of, you know, high mass clusters we can find, but we can probably do something with the scaling relation, I think, is right, which is going to, even if we don't manage to get a whole 500 square degrees by the time.
Other questions for Bill?
Yes, real quick. What's the luminosity of your Z1.4 source cluster?
I think it's about 4 times 10 to the 44, I think. But, yeah.
But how do you put the field that was affecting
it? I think in total there was a lot stacked up on that field. It was like a few hundred. It was 300 kiloseconds or something. It was a lot. It was a really deep field. It was, yeah.
It wasn't in like a 10 kilosecond field.
No. No, it's one of these. Actually, it's one of these fields which was observed with some ESO imaging survey as well, which is where we found the original optical image for the. So you got quite lucky with that.
Other questions?
So if not, okay, let's think again.